at 3 clinics and through telehealth. Over the weekend, she told me they're looking really closely at what might still be legal after that 7-day waiting period is up.
So it's going to be working closely with legal advisors in a really rapidly and changing environment. That's what I foresee in the next 7 days and likely beyond that.
Grant says CareFem is also poised to increase capacity for surgical abortion if necessary at its clinics, but they only have so much capacity. A spokeswoman for another company called Wisp, which provides abortion pills over telehealth, told me they're rushing to put together a plan to let patients stock up on mifepristone in advance of whatever might happen in court. And both of these companies, CareFem and Wisp, and many other providers, also have been preparing to switch to a different regimen if mifepristone becomes unavailable. Most medication abortions in this country use mifepristone plus a second drug called misoprostol. But misoprostol alone is used around the world, and many U.S. providers are looking at switching to that approach if they need to. But some advocates tell me they worry misoprostol could be the next target for anti-abortion groups.
Sarah, if the FDA has to take the pills off the market, will patients have any other options?
You know, right now, many people are using alternative sources to get abortion pills, often online from overseas. And already, more than a dozen states, including Texas, where this lawsuit started, have banned all types of abortion in most cases. You know, I talked to Elisa Wells with the group Plan C that provides information about some of those alternative sources. She says tens of thousands of people are getting pills this way, and she says that's likely to escalate depending on the outcome of this case.
That's NPR's Sarah McCammon. Sarah, thanks for providing clarity.
Thank you.
We turn now to Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Good morning, Senator, and thanks for being on the program.
Good morning, Layla. It's great to be on.
So, Senator, you said Judge Kaczmarek's ruling on Friday, who you referred to as notoriously conservative, was truly shocking. What shocked you?
Well, Layla, what's shocking here is that one judge in Amarillo, Texas, should not be able to decide whether a woman in Montana or Wisconsin or every woman in the country can get the care they need. This drug, as been pointed out by your correspondents, have been used in half of the abortions in the U.S. It's been on the market for more than 20 years after a 4-year approval process by the FDA, and it's used safely in over 60 countries. This is just another example of extremists trying to take away women's rights to make their own decisions about their health care. We think they should be able to make those decisions, not one judge in Amarillo, Texas, and certainly not politicians.
But look, it's been clear that anti-abortion rights groups have been working to make abortion illegal for decades, which culminated in the overturning of Roe v. Wade. They've been doing that work through the federal courts, which Senator Mitch McConnell helped to reshape with more conservative judges when he was majority leader. So what can your party actually do to counter this?
Well, I share everyone's frustration about what this judge did. I hope you can tell that. But the first answer is to fight
this
aggressive...
Well, not everyone's frustrated. Some people support what this judge did.
All right. Everyone that is interested in getting their own health care. Mm-hmm. All right. So as you look at this, first, you got to fight it aggressively in the courts. And remember, he did a really weird thing. Mm-hmm. There's a 6-year statute of limitations that covers when you can start appealing these things after they've been decided. This just hasn't been used in a way that he's used it before. So, and even his own, the lawyers challenging it, noted that they hadn't seen anything like this before. So in the Fifth Circuit, which is, yes, conservative, you could see them using something like that as a reason to at least stay this beyond the week so it doesn't take effect, or in fact, ruling the other way. And then the Supreme Court, same thing, based on this procedural mess that he got us into as a country, because you could actually use this for any drug. You could use it for contraception. Some judge could say the same thing. They could say, well, yeah, okay, that was 20 years ago, and I know you have to be able to appeal in 6 years, but I find an exception to that because I didn't think you should get your approval process done in 4. That's how absurd this is. So I think people should be watching for that procedural way out of this mess.
What do you think happens if it ends up at the Supreme Court?
Look, no one can predict. I just look at the facts here. I look at the fact that the American Medical Association, which isn't like a radical group, they actually said immediately in a very strong statement, there is no evidence that people are harmed by having access to this safe and effective medication. We have got decades of proof to support that statement. There is a reason why judges don't usually enter these kinds of orders. Mm-hmm. Doctors and scientists make these decisions, not judges. So I think that's a different posture before the Supreme Court than even the Dobbs decision.
Now, you've pointed out, and many have pointed out, the majority of Americans support some access to abortion health care. And you co-sponsored the Women's Health Protection Act, which would codify the right to abortion access as it was laid out in Roe v. Wade. A 2022 version of the bill failed when Democrats did control the House. Now Democrats don't control the House. So what is the Democratic strategy in Congress when it comes to access to abortion?
The first is to push this bill forward. And yes, we don't believe right now those Republicans in the House, those MAGA Republicans, and actually Republican leaders in the House, as opposed to some of the voters out there, where you rightly point out 70-80% of the people are with us on this, are going to let this bill go forward. But that doesn't mean that Democrats in the Senate won't keep pushing it. We just have put together that bill. We just put it forward after we did in the last Congress. The House under Democrats had voted for the bill before, so we'll keep pushing it. We also can push other votes on this, including the availability of this abortion drug. We have to be aggressive, but the people of this country have to be aggressive. Once again, we call on the people of this country to come out and say what they think, that this is an outrageous decision and that this judge in Amarillo, Texas, shouldn't be making decisions for the women of this country. And it ultimately ends up in the election.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Layla. It was great to be on.
You may not have heard of artist Dior Greenwood, but you may already have one of her works in your home. She's among the four artists whose designs appear in a new U.S. Postal Service stamp collection called The Art of the Skateboard.
I knew I had to create something that my community would be proud to say, like, yes, she's part of our community.
Greenwood's design reflects her Navajo culture and features a skateboard decorated with eagle feathers.
We use them to pray. We use them to just bless our food, our water. Our existence, really.
That design will appear on millions of stamps.
Me being allowed to, you know, express artwork on this level kind of will put the Navajo Nation back where they need to be, and that is on the map, so people know where we come from.
The stamp also reflects Greenwood's love of skateboarding, which she says came from her younger brother.
It brought my brother pure joy, and I figured, like, oh, I want some of that. Like, let me try to get into that. So I would steal his skateboard every now and then when he wasn't around.
The Postal Service says the stamp collection's vibrant designs capture the excitement of skateboarding.
There's a lot of great creative energy in the skateboarding subculture, and we thought it was time to recognize that.
William Gicker is the USPS Director of Stamp Services.
What goes on to our national stamp program is really representative of the full nation.
And skateboarding, once seen as a rebellious sport, now gets the Postal Service's stamp of approval. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Alex Crow with you at 8:19 on this Monday morning. Still to come this hour here on the program, NPR's A. Martinez will speak with ProPublica reporter Dan Shorts about how trains are getting longer and railroad staff is being cut short, all of that creating very dangerous conditions. Obviously, that's been in the news a lot lately. That's coming up in just a few minutes on Morning Edition. Here on WPR.
PBS Wisconsin Education invites you to explore the seeds of spring at pbswisconsin.org/education. Nurture budding curiosity with fun, free kid-tested programs, games, and hands-on activities. Count on PBS Wisconsin to be there wherever adventure sprouts, at school, at home, or on the go, on your TV, tablets, and mobile devices. Grow a love of learning through play at pbswisconsin.org/education.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Dementia care specialists provide free support and education for people with dementia and their caregivers to ensure quality of life while living at home. For more info, call 262-605-6646.
Radio in weather, we've got a great week in front of us. Highs in the 50s and 70s throughout the day today and tomorrow. By the time Wednesday comes around, highs in the 70s in the north and even possibly 80s in the south. On Thursday, 60s in the north and 70s in the south. Back to 50s and 70s by Friday. I'm Alex Crow. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Angie. Angie's List is now Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners get home projects done well, from everyday repairs to dream remodels. Reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app. From Fisher Investments, Fisher Investments' team of specialists tailor portfolios to each client's long-term goals. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investments in securities involve the risk of loss. And from Workday, committed to helping organizations adapt to change, using real-time data to uncover insights, stay decision-ready, and prepare for whatever's next. The finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Since 2012, nearly all of North America's biggest railroad companies, such as Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern, adopted Precision Scheduled Railroading, or PSR, as their standard way of operating their freight train service. The U.S. Government Accountability Office put out a report in December where they spoke to railroad companies, worker unions, and shippers. And while nothing is set in stone for what defines PSR, they all generally agree that reductions in staff and longer trains are the basics.
In the past, about a 1.4-mile long train was considered huge. Now trains are 2, even 3 miles long.
That's Dan Schwartz. He and his colleagues at ProPublica dove in to examine precision scheduled railroading.
Long trains are just one tenet of PSR. Other things they're doing to reduce cost is they've dramatically laid off a lot of their workforce. So since 2015, they've laid off about a fifth. And a lot of those cuts have been in maintenance workers. There's fewer people to catch trains in disrepair. Also, these longer trains, another tenant, tend to require more maintenance because they've got more components, more stress on those machines. And another big thing they're doing is they're trying to get the trains moving quicker in and out of the yards because an idle train makes them no money.
For railroad companies, precision scheduled railroading has allowed them to cut costs and boost profits. And despite data from the Federal Railroad Administration showing that last year the country averaged roughly 3 train derailments per day, the railroad industry claims PSR has led to fewer problems. However, what do railroad professionals say?
The problem is there's not very good data out there, and that's a little bit of a quandary of the regulator's own making. But, you know, when we talk with people in the industry, outside of the industry, looking into the industry, basically experts, they say long trains are not necessarily more dangerous, but under this system of PSR, doing more with less, the conditions are ripe for long trains to be dangerous. You know, those dangers are not being mitigated.
Is it because precision scheduled railroading is still fairly a new thing, and maybe there isn't enough time that's gone by to really get some data, or are these things just not being looked at?
It's really more the latter. The Federal Railroad Administration, they're really the sole regulator of safety on the railroad industry, the FRA. They, for nearly 2 decades, have been noting long trains and long trains derailing and crashing, but they've never been systematically recording data on these long trains. We looked at more than 600 of their investigative reports going back to 2005 to 2020, and we found nearly 20 derailments of long trains and in which they crashed for reasons associated with their length. You know, it paints a pretty alarming picture, but the FRA is still not convinced of their danger, and they've never been recording systematically the length of trains, which means we can't draw any trends from the, you know, the universe of trains running in the U.S. And it's really, we just have anecdotes.
So there's no rules, regulations, protocols when it comes to making trains longer, because just common sense to me, Dan, makes me think, well, if something is longer, it might be harder to control.
Yeah, you're correct on that. We've talked to a lot of workers. An engineer who drives the train often needs more training to handle a long train. They aren't given that. You know, there's a lot of other requirements that should be met to satisfy safety concerns. But to date, there's no regulation capping the length of trains. Of course, Congress could, you know, step in at any time and try to do something about that. State lawmakers have tried, and in every instance we've seen, they've been rebuffed by court, saying only the feds can regulate the railroad industry. In the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA, they could impose an emergency order or something along those lines to cap the length of trains, but they told us that, you know, to do that would require good data so that they could make a strong argument that wouldn't get slapped down in court. And, well, they've never been recording the data.
That train in East Palestine, Ohio, had 150 cars attached. Did the length of that train play a factor in the crash, or was it something else?
So far, it doesn't seem the length of that train played a factor. That train was 1.8 miles long. What investigators believe did cause that derailment was an overheated wheel bearing. But even there, even though the length probably didn't play a factor, it does seem, according to our reporting at ProPublica, PSR played a role in that derailment. We learned that Norfolk Southern, the company that owned that train, has a policy that allows that help desk to wave crews off of an alarm. And that very thing happened late last year in October in Sandusky, Ohio, with the Norfolk Southern train. It had a hot wheel. It tripped a detector. The detector told the help desk, "You got a problem here." The help desk told the crew, "Continue on." And then minutes later, the train derailed and dumped molten wax on what is normally a very busy street. Fortunately, no one was on the street at the time and got injured. But it's, you know, that kind of policy is very typical of precision scheduled railroading. It prioritizes moving trains quickly and efficiently over safety.
Ultimately, what do you think it's going to take to get people thinking about this a little bit more, at least offer some kind of real investigation and study into what this is and if it's safe enough for the rail industry to continue using it? I mean, I understand if it's something that's more effective and cuts down on costs and increases profit, I can understand how, you know, a business would want to do it. But if it's causing, or if there's even a chance that it's causing all of these derailments, why wouldn't anyone think, hey, we should kind of take a pause and figure this out?
I think that moment might be now. This East Palestine derailment is a incredible disaster, and it's really captured the national consciousness. And, you know, trains are on the mainstream news in ways that they haven't been in the past. I would think that would lead to some action in Congress on this to give either the FRA some more teeth or maybe get the FRA started on a rules-making process to put some more regulations on the industry. But I can't imagine all of this pressure, all of this attention on the railroad industry and some positive change doesn't come out of it.
That's Dan Schwartz, a reporter with ProPublica. Dan, thanks.
Thank you, A.
This is NPR News.
A Navy warship is being renamed to honor Robert Smalls, a five-term South Carolina congressman and the first black man to command a U.S. naval vessel. But he first made his mark in the Civil War as
a former slave who commandeered a Confederate ship and turned it over to the Union Navy.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. I'm Alex Crow. Happy to be with you on this Monday here for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29. News from NPR and WPR starts now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Biden is preparing to meet with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in Belfast. As Villa Marx reports, Biden and Sunak will mark 25 years since a peace deal that ended decades of bloodshed in Northern Ireland.
Sunak called the Good Friday Agreement a, quote, incredible moment in our nation's history that was a powerfully rare example of people doing the previously unthinkable. He said it was now his responsibility to, quote, make good on the agreement's promise, despite Brexit's destabilization of local politics and an elevated terrorism threat level. He'll meet with Biden in the Northern Irish capital Tuesday evening.
One of two state lawmakers in Tennessee expelled by House colleagues is expected to be voted back in today by a council in Nashville. Democrat Justin Jones was recently ousted by Republican lawmakers for taking part in a gun control protest on the House floor. Jim Shulman is the vice mayor of Nashville.
They're speaking out. They're speaking out on some serious issues, and they deserve to be heard. This is democracy.
The other expelled Democratic representative, Justin Pearson, is still waiting to hear how the Shelby County Commission plans to address his vacancy. Jones and Pearson were among those calling on Republicans in the Tennessee House to support stricter gun control laws. It followed the shooting deaths of six people at a private Christian elementary school. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Both political parties are proposing tax plans for the state during a time when Wisconsin has a record budget surplus. Evan Casey has more on a report that looks into the plans.
Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu proposed a flat income tax of 3.25% for all residents. That would give a tax cut of over $100,000 for the wealthiest in the state, according to a new report from Wisconsin Policy Forum. In a plan proposed by Governor Tony Evers, Wisconsinites who make more than $1 million would see an average tax increase of nearly $40,000. Jason Stein is a report's author.
They're really different in their effects overall. But they have this one similarity, and that is a focus of a lot of their changes on people at very upper income levels.
It's unlikely either plan is approved, as Republicans on the Budget Committee have said they won't support a flat tax. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A recently released audit finds Wisconsin officials often lagged behind on requirements for monitoring people on parole or probation. Sarah Lear has more.
More than 60,000 Wisconsinites are subject to monitoring and other restrictions. That's because they've been sentenced to probation or are on what's known as parole or extended supervision after getting out of prison. But a new report from Wisconsin's nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau finds the Department of Corrections failed to complete initial risk assessments in a timely manner more than a third of the time. Those check-ins are meant to gauge someone's risk of reoffending. They also help determine how strict the terms of someone's supervision are. The Department of Corrections secretary is disputing those findings, arguing auditors used flawed methodology. He also says auditors didn't fully account for assessments that couldn't be completed because the people being supervised had fled or otherwise didn't cooperate. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A really nice week of weather is in store for Wisconsinites. Today, highs in the 50s and 70s throughout the state. More of the same tomorrow. On Wednesday, in the northern part of the state, highs are expected to reach the 70s, and in the southern part of the state, highs could hit the 80s. On Thursday, highs in the 60s and 70s. Chance for some rain to move in finally by Friday afternoon. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And from Indeed, a hiring platform committed to helping businesses of all sizes. Businesses can invite candidates to apply, then schedule and conduct interviews in one place. Indeed.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faldil in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The U.S. Supreme Court is facing ethics questions after ProPublica reported last week that Justice Clarence Thomas for years accepted luxury trips from a billionaire GOP megadonor without disclosing them. Thomas responded to the report with a statement. In it, he said in part that he was, quote, advised that such hospitality from close personal friends with no business before the court was not reportable. Stricter disclosure rules went into effect last month, but will justices comply? Northwestern University law professor emeritus Stephen Lubet says he doesn't think so, and he joins us now to talk about it. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
Good to be with you.
So why are you so doubtful that these rules will be effective?
Well, there's no enforcement mechanism, and in the past, the justices have adhered to them when they wanted to and not when they didn't. Justice Thomas says he'll follow the new interpretation. I don't really doubt him about that, but it's all very contingent because Chief Justice Roberts and before him Chief Justice Rehnquist have both said that the declined to say that the rules were validly applicable to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, you said there's no enforcement body. There's no way to make sure justices do comply with this.
They're the Supreme Court. They do what they want.
So the Judicial Conference of the United States makes the rules, but they don't enforce the rules? I mean, what does this body do?
Well, they make the rules. There's an enforcement mechanism that, you know, the judges have life tenure. So short of impeachment, there's no penalty that's applicable to the to judges at any level in the federal courts. There is a system in the lower courts of reporting, and it can lead to censure or reprimand, but it does not apply to the U.S. Supreme Court.
But this is the highest court in the land, and it's important that Americans trust the court and there isn't a perception of conflict of interest here. So did justices never have to disclose? Were there no rules before March 14th when this went into effect?
There were rules before March 14th regarding gift disclosure. The justices said that they would comply with them. They do file annual reports disclosing gifts. I would say that the previous rules definitely covered at least some parts of Justice Thomas's excursions with Mr. Crow. The new rules are much more specific and would absolutely require reporting of this sort of travel and lavish hospitality.
Now, this ProPublica report on Justice Thomas, yes, it's prompted fresh concerns about reforms, conflicts of interest, investigations, but it's not new. These concerns have been around for decades with different justices. What do you want to see to actually address this if this rule is not the answer?
Well, the Supreme Court is the only court in the United States that has never adopted a written code of ethics. Every other court has a written code. The U.S. Supreme Court has strenuously resisted announcing what its own standards of ethics are. That should be remedied. They should adopt a code of conduct. At the very least, this will let the public know what the justices expect of themselves. And there will be transparency that we have not had in the past.
Stephen Lubet is an emeritus professor of law at Northwestern University. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
All right, what's more annoying than paying taxes? Well, shopping for health insurance is pretty high up there. But Sarah Bowden with member station WESA in Pittsburgh reports that in a growing number of states, filing taxes can actually make finding health insurance a little easier.
Deanna Avijanita does people's taxes in Maryland, and when she tells her clients they might qualify for low-cost health care coverage, many don't believe her.
It's like a taboo, right? Like, oh, no, this is just for a very low-income people. No, it's not. It's not.
She's talking about Medicaid, or the coverage you can buy on the health insurance marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act. These plans are now more affordable than they have been in years. And in Maryland, taxpayers can find out their eligibility by simply checking a box on their tax returns. Doing so doesn't automatically enroll them in health coverage, but it creates a warm handoff that gives a consumer an estimate of the kind of financial assistance they qualify for.
My experience with the people that I have asked if they have applied, my experience is like 80% of them have qualified.
you do still have to follow through and sign up for coverage. Yet, in the windy nightmare that is health insurance, what Maryland created is remarkably efficient.
I think anything that helps get uninsured individuals connected to coverage through something they already have to do every year is a win-win for everyone.
Antoinette Krause of the Pennsylvania Health Access Network says she was a big advocate for her state to follow Maryland's lead, which it did last year. Krause notes that the number of uninsured Pennsylvanians and Americans is at an all-time low.
So the folks that are left that don't have health coverage are often some of the folks that are hardest to find.
But everyone has to file their taxes. By next year, a total of 10 states will have some form of easy enrollment program, including Maine, California, and New Jersey. This is all happening at a time of incredible churn for health insurance, due in large part to the end of COVID-19 era policies, which are forcing people to re-enroll in Medicaid or find new insurance if they make too much money. So having a simple way to connect people to healthcare coverage is a good idea. Coleman Drake is a health policy expert at the University of Pittsburgh, where he studies insurance markets.
Most enrollees are eligible, if not for zero premium plans with, I should mention, really generous coverage. They can typically get them for under $10, under $20 a month.
Drake cautions, using the tax system to point people toward health insurance isn't going to get everyone covered. Only about 10,000 Marylanders have gotten insurance this way since 2020, and that's less than 3% of the total uninsured population in that state. The number in Pennsylvania is estimated to be super small, too. But Drake says there needs to be more initiatives that cut through red tape and lower the administrative burden of getting health insurance. And what Maryland started and Pennsylvania continued is a step forward.
Uninsurance in general is extremely costly to society. So whatever we can do here to make signing up for health insurance easy, I think is an advantage.
This lower cost coverage is out there for consumers. To not take advantage of it is like leaving money on the table. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden in Pittsburgh.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with WESA and Kaiser Health News. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Alex Crowe. Really happy to be with you at 8:42 on this Monday. You don't need me to tell you, but farming is a huge industry here in Wisconsin, and more farmers in the Midwest are planting off-season crops to help protect the soil and reduce fertilizer use. And the next farm bill may make it easier to adopt this practice. We'll dive into the push for cover crops in just a few minutes here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Rob Savage.
And I'm Mary Savage, and we're members of the WPR Signature Circle.
Wisconsin Public Radio really epitomizes the whole Wisconsin idea, that we serve the whole public. What's really important is having that honest news broker. It's a great thing, and I want to make sure that that's there for however long we can make it be there.
For information about naming WPR in your will or trust, visit WPRLegacy.org.
Support for WPR comes from SFM, providing workers' comp programs dedicated to saving business owners time while keeping employees safe and productive. SFM, workerscomp.com. SFM, the work comp experts. Credit Union, a local financial cooperative dedicated to supporting members' financial well-being online, in branch, and on mobile. UW Credit Union is here for every you.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In news, the United States says it's investigating how several top secret documents related to the war in Ukraine were leaked online. This comes as Ukraine is reportedly preparing for a spring offensive against Russia. Two police officers are dead after being shot during a traffic stop in western Wisconsin on Saturday. The suspect in that incident was also killed. Those officers have not yet been identified.
Wisconsin is set to receive around $139 million this year to upgrade drinking water infrastructure. And a new Wisconsin Policy Forum report found a proposed flat income tax would give an average tax cut of more than $100,000 for the wealthiest residents of the state. In weather, highs in the 50s and 70s today, more of the same tomorrow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting. Your Part-Time Controller helps nonprofit organizations with their accounting needs, remotely or in person. More at yourparttimecontroller.com. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Z-Quil Pure Z's gummies, designed with melatonin for occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep naturally. Learn more at zquil.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Farmers usually plant in the spring and harvest in fall. Now more are beginning to plant crops that cover the ground in the off-season instead of leaving fields empty. These are known as cover crops, and efforts are underway to get more farmers to adopt the practice. Jonathan All of St. Louis Public Radio explains how they're used and how they can help farmers and the climate.
Tim Gottman's 2,400-acre farm in northeast Missouri looks harvested. But among the remnants of corn stalks are blobs of green plants that are thriving despite the cold and windy conditions of early spring in the Midwest. Gottman points to acres of gently sloping land wet from a recent rain.
So all this water would be running that way, and if them terraces weren't there and this green, the wheat and rye weren't here, it would just allow the water to run faster and take the soil with it. And when the soil's leaving, your fertilizer's going with it.
Gottman is a big fan of the off-season plants, and he says they're working to improve the bottom line on his corn and soybean farm. He's not alone. The University of Illinois completed a study using a combination of USDA reports and satellite images to produce the most accurate survey of cover crop usage in the Midwest. The study found in the past 10 years, the number of acres using the practice tripled, but it comes with a big caveat.
It is certainly not at a level that would be necessary for some of the challenges, like the water quality challenges, like soil erosion. It's going to take a lot more acres to get there.
Jonathan Kappas is the director of the University of Illinois' Ag Policy Program. He says the new data shows the cover crop usage went from 1.8% to 7.2%. A big jump, but still a small number of acres. Kappas says he hopes there will be more incentives for them put into the farm bill that's up for renewal this year. He says there could be more bipartisan support for a program that can help reduce fertilizer costs and work to address climate change, because cover crops can also help take carbon out of the atmosphere.
We can use it maybe to design up policies that will help incentivize the behavior, help incentivize the practice. It can maybe help jumpstart that by showing, you know, funds going in for this practice will get response on the ground and we can measure it.
The off-season planting strategy is also getting endorsements from large agriculture groups, including the National Corn and Soybean Growers Associations. Kurt Beckman is the director of environmental programs for Missouri Corn. He says there has been a lot of progress, but there needs to be more. But he also says it's important to farmers to be encouraged and not forced.
Really just want to make sure that it's voluntary. We don't want to mandate anything. We don't want farmers to be forced into planting cover crops on their acres. We want them to make those decisions. They know their land better than anyone.
65% of Tim Gottman's farmland has cover crops on it, but he understands why more farmers don't plant them. He says large corporate-owned farms don't want to put in the time or effort to take care of the land.
Because you got plants out there growing on you on a field that you're wanting to plant, and it's three counties away, and rain's coming, you're not heading a sprayer over there. They just want the dirt because they're not really farming for the same reason I am.
The current farm bill expires in September, and incentives for cover crops will be a tiny sliver of what looks to be a more than a $500 billion package. But there will be countless programs and initiatives competing for those dollars. For NPR News, I'm Jonathan All in Rolla, Missouri.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Alex Crowe. So happy to be with you at 8:49 on this Monday morning. We've got lots more to come here on the program on Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll talk about reggaeton music and how it's popular all over the world. But sometimes its videos and lyrics are degrading to women. So we'll take a stab at the question of whether you can be a feminist and still be a fan of reggaeton. That's up next on WPR.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, going on Medicare, the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center offers no-cost, unbiased Medicare workshops for those new to Medicare or those wanting to learn more. For more info, contact the ADRC at 262-605-6646.
Strapped. It's at Madison Central Library, April 11th at 7 p.m. Find out more at wpr.org/presents.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Quick check of sports now. The Milwaukee Bucks fell to the Toronto Raptors in their final game of the regular season last night. No matter, the Bucks still get the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. They'll play the winner of the NBA's play-in tournament. Those four teams in that tournament are the Miami Heat, Atlanta Hawks, Toronto Raptors, and Chicago Bulls. The Brewers moved to 7-2 on the season with a 6-1 win over the St. Louis Cardinals yesterday. The Brewers are in Arizona tonight, so it's a late start, 8:40 Central Time. And Jon Rahm wins the Masters by shooting 12 under par for the tournament. In weather, a chance for some spotty showers today, highs in the 50s and 70s across the state. More of the same tomorrow, and on Wednesday, highs in the 70s and 80s. I'm Alex Crowe. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Terrence Blanchard made history last season when his opera Fire Shut Up in My Bones was the first work by a Black composer staged by the Metropolitan Opera. Now, another Blanchard opera is opening at the Met tonight. It's a retelling of the dramatic story of boxer Emil Griffith. It's called Champion. Tom Vitale has this preview.
Champion was jazz composer Terrence Blanchard's first opera. It premiered 10 years ago in St. Louis, followed by productions in San Francisco, Washington, and Boston. But at the Met, says Blanchard, the staging has ratcheted up to another level.
I can't even count the number of people we have in the chorus this time. We have 20 to 30 dancers. You put all of that together, plus a full orchestra and jazz ensemble, it makes for a huge production.
And it's a production that includes a full-size boxing ring on the Met stage. Champion tells the story of Emil Griffith, a closeted gay boxer, in an era when gay people were outcasts, who rises from obscurity to become world champion. And, in one of the great tragedies in sports history, kills his homophobic arch rival in the ring. The centerpiece of the opera is an aria called What Makes a Man a Man, sung by Ryan Speedo Green in the role of Emil Griffith.
What makes this man a man? Is it a life he's lived?
Champion is told in flashbacks. An older Emil Griffith, suffering from dementia, looks back at his career, filled with regret for the death he caused in the ring. Terrence Blanchard says his opera is ultimately about redemption and forgiveness.
What he said in his autobiography really blew me away. He said, I killed a man and the world forgave me, but yet I love the man and the world wants to kill me. And to me, everything that I've written for this opera is centered around that moment, because we have to get past all of this. You know, it's time for us to grow up as a society.
The Metropolitan Opera has commissioned Terrence Blanchard to compose a new opera. He says he hasn't picked the topic yet. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
For 3 years in a row, Bad Bunny has been the world's most streamed artist on Spotify.
Titi me preguntó si tengo muchas novias. Muchas novias. Hoy tengo a una, mañana otra. Me la voy a llevar la toa pa' un VIP.
Bad Bunny is at the forefront of a global obsession over reggaeton. The thing is, artists in that genre often write sexually explicit lyrics, sometimes becoming quite misogynistic. Patricia Velasquez created the first Puerto Rican reggaeton archive, and throughout the project, she's been haunted by a question one of her college classmates once asked her. How can you be a feminist and listen to reggaeton? At first, Velasquez was shocked. She didn't know how to respond.
Because no one had ever questioned my morals that way. I said something like, I listen to reggaeton, and I listen to it every day. I'm a feminist, and I dance to reggaeton the way I want.
That clip came from some reporting that my colleague Lisette Arevalo did for NPR's podcast, Radio Ambulante. First, she takes us back to the beginning of reggaeton.
Some say it was born in Jamaica, others in Panama and in New York City, and of course in Puerto Rico.
One thing's for sure, its commercial strength was established in Puerto Rico.
Since its birth, young people rapped or sang crude and confrontational lyrics, and they were often violent songs that talked about what was happening in the streets. But above all, they made reference to the country's social conditions. Unemployment rates of up to 59% in some areas, schools in poor conditions, government corruption, and violence linked to drug trafficking.
Many songs sounded something like this. It's from 1990. It's Vico C with La Recta Final. Dinero puede controlar hasta la corte, tanto en el sur como allá en el norte. Creen que lo lujoso es la salvación, y ahí es que el corrupto entra en acción, aplastando, abusando, asesinando. Not everyone in Puerto Rico was in love with reggaeton at first. Some related it to a criminal subculture. And it was impossible to ignore the lyrics that reduced women to objects of male fantasy.
Especially because of the content of its videos, which usually featured women in G-strings rubbing themselves on the singers.
But eventually, more voices entered the conversation.
One of the first persons to change the direction of reggaeton was Ivy Queen, who is considered the queen of reggaeton.
Lisette Arevalo says Ivy Queen broke through in a world dominated by men.
It was not easy, of course. Ivy Queen has said that their reaction was always critical, that she was too short, that her voice was too thick, almost masculine. But she has said that this difference was her weapon.
She began taking reggaeton in new directions in 1997, but in 2003, Ivy Queen released perhaps her most important song, Yo Quiero Bailar.
A complete revolution for music because it talked about women's consent.
Ever since that breakthrough, many LGBTQI+ folks, women and feminists have embraced reggaeton.
It is also a genre that has not left aside its roots, the social protest at all levels. And women have been there giving new meanings to the songs and talking about the urgent issues that affect them.
And perhaps one of the greatest ambassadors of reggaeton has embraced this message. Here's Bad Bunny with his song, Yo Perreo Sola.
It is a song dedicated precisely to the freedom of women to have sex and dance whenever they want, with whomever they want, and without anyone hitting on them or pressuring them.
But even Bad Bunny isn't absolved from objectifying women. He's done it too. So back to the original question then. Can you be a feminist and like reggaeton? Patricia Velasquez of the Reggaeton Archive finally landed on this answer.
Porque puedo. Porque en mi feminismo precisamente me lo permite.
Because I can. Because my feminism allows it. It allows me to decide what I like, what I listen to, how I dance, and how I don't. It gives me the authority over my body and my decisions.
Our thanks to Lisette Arevalo from the podcast Radio Ambulante for her reporting on this.
Más vale que las palabras lindas te rindan, o por mi descendencia y los ovarios que me guindan. Me importa poco de lo que me tildan, nunca he creído que calladita.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Falta.
Yo los mato rápido, el ritmo de capitó. Yo chambeo plazo automático. Yo nunca me la voy a dejar montar, si es grande.
And I'm Alex Crowe. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to John Davis, who helps bring us the news each morning. It's 8:59, Morning Classics, on the way after the news on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from U.S. Venture in Appleton, dedicated to having a people-first culture with a commitment to giving back to communities locally and globally. More information is at usventure.com. Finding a better way.
WGTD FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.